Hello and welcome to the Leadership Learned podcast, brought to you by IDG, the Leadership Specialists. Each episode, we examine the behaviours, skills and attributes required to improve human performance through effective leadership. We discuss the latest thinking and issues affecting leadership from the classroom to the boardroom to provide tangible insights as we go beyond the clichés to prove that leaders are made, not born. Before we get going with this episode, just wanted to bring to your attention that this is the first part of two. Our conversation with Jake went on for well over an hour, and we like to keep other episodes down to around 35-40 minutes. But we also didn't want to lose a lot of the valuable insights that we went into during the conversation. So we've split it into two parts, and this episode is the first part. And as you'll hear, we basically tell the story in chronological order of Jake and his expedition to Everest, and didn't want you to get to the end of this and go, well, hang on, he's only halfway there. So next week, don't worry, you'll have the second part in your podcast feed. In the meantime, hope you enjoy. In this episode, we're delighted to be joined by Jake Mayer, a record-breaking mountaineer who has just returned from his second successful summit of Mount Everest. But the full story of the expedition is not about success. It's also about failure and resilience and teamwork, leadership, collaboration, in other words, many of the things we deal with every day in our working environments. And that's why we've got Jake on, to share those lessons that he learned on two of the highest mountains in the world that can also be applied in our professional lives. Thanks for joining us today, Jake.
Thanks, Matt. Great to see you.
We're also joined by Nigel Girling, who regular listeners will know as our own leadership guru, former member of Government Task Force on Leadership and a chartered companion at the Chartered Management Institute. Hi, Nigel.
Hiya. I'm not that dull, I promise.
So before we start, I just wanted to detail some of your climbing achievements, Jake. And they are, you became the youngest Briton to climb Everest at the age of 21 in 2005. And at the same point, that made you the youngest man in the world to complete the seven summits. In 2006, you set a record for the fastest ascent of the highest mountain in every state in the contiguous USA. And then after three attempts in 2018, you became only the 10th and youngest Briton ever to climb K2. And at this point, we should also mention that Jake is our colleague here at IDG, which, as you can imagine, makes comparing stories in the pub a bit of a humbling experience. So we want to talk about your expedition from this year, and you know, spoiler alert, you did get to the top of summit, but that wasn't the point of the expedition in itself. Tell us what the expedition was.
Absolutely. So, like so many people, the COVID years, if we call it that, slightly tempered my ability to get out and around and climb, and so I had this dream, this desire to want to do a big trip for quite some time. And the main focus for the expedition was to try and climb Kanchenjunga, which is the third highest mountain in the world. It's 8,586 meters high, only about 250 meters lower than Mount Everest. And also, because of its location on the border between Nepal and India, is the highest point in India. And this has been something I've been wanting to do for many years, especially having already climbed Everest and K2. I guess I was being very unimaginative in my just gently working down the ranking table. But these kind of expeditions are long times away. And with busy schedule at work with IDG and, of course, busy schedule at home, I recognize that being able to take long two-month expeditions every year is not going to be a regular occurrence. So making the most of my trip out to Nepal would be prudent with my expedition. And so not only trying Kanchenjunga, but also attempting a return to Everest and try and climb Lhotse, which is the fourth highest mountain. So I called it Project 314 because in order of attempt, it was going to be the third highest, the first highest, and then the fourth highest. And so that was the dream at the outset of the expedition.
What inspired you to do this? You know, you've done Everest, you've broken all these records, you've done K2, which was, you know, a very long held dream of yours. What then gives you that urge? You know, where does it come from? Where does that urge to do these things come from?
It comes from a number of different places. And whilst I joke, I think there is some truth in the matter that the first time I went to Everest, and perhaps some of the mountains before that, they were the gateway drugs. They were the experiences which lured me into this world, which opened up a side to the physical environment and the opportunity to travel that was amazing and a huge opportunity, but also opened up this opportunity to look at myself. It was Ed Hillary, of course, who first climbed Everest in 1953, who said that it is not the mountain we conquer, but ourselves. And that has always been a sort of a fascinating opportunity from any of these adventures, not just the chance to sort of see and experience these incredible environments and the people you spend your time with, but also to look in the mirror and to understand what you are capable of. Mm-hmm. And you know, Everest has become a trope and has become a cliche for all of us. You know, we talk about finding your own Everests, mm-hmm. don't we, and conquering mm-hmm. your own Everests. So it's part of our everyday nomenclature. And that is something that still inspires me. The question is that once you've done one mountain, you then want to push the limit. You know, how can you keep on improving? How can you keep moving forwards?
So we're going to talk through Project 314 in a chronological order. So let's start at the beginning. How were things at the start? What were the things that you had to get organized and get done, and how important are the early stages and in terms of contributing to the success of the overall expedition?
Well, one of the key things here was around before I even went away was essentially the stakeholder management required. You know, I'm not young, free and single anymore, so I had to get the buy-in from my family. We've got three children at school, my wife works full-time, so how do you, you know, ensure that you get permission to go away for 2 months and that the house isn't going to fall over or the household isn't going to fall over. The other piece is about the funding for expeditions like this, that they're not cheap, and alas, I can't pay for it out of my petty cash. So it's getting sponsorship. So like life in our day-to-day in our organisations, the stakeholder buy-in, the management of expectations, the trading of favours, not in a Machiavellian way, but actually the genuine positioning of here is a great opportunity. I would like you essentially to buy into it. And this is what I can offer in return.
So you got there, you got all your kit there, you got everything there. I know you did a long hike into base camp. And one of the things that I found interesting is the acclimatization process, which, you know, and this which seems to me a lot like if you go into a new organization, you need to sort of get a feel for things and the way it all works. And just take us through what that acclimatization process is.
Mm. So whenever you go up it to altitude, of course, into the atmosphere, there is a reduction in pressure, there's less available oxygen. So your body has to acclimatize, your body has to get used to the lack of oxygen or the reduction in oxygen that you have in every single breath. At the summit of Everest, there is less than a third of the oxygen that there is at sea level. So if any of us were to suddenly sort of jump in a helicopter, and this is making a rather large assumption that helicopters can fly this high, and to be taken straight to the summit, we'd be unconscious within minutes from the pressure and, more to the point, the oxygen change. And I think your point around a little bit like coming into a new organization is very apt. You know, there are certain similarities that you expect each time. However, the specific conditions are always slightly different, and therefore treating every expedition as a unique experience is really key. In between my two Everest expeditions, 18 years had elapsed. And of course, we change, you know, our bodies change, our ability our bounce back ability, our resilience does change.
You were part of a team that was attempting to climb Kanchenjunga, but teams are built differently in mountaineering to how we might expect them to be. Tell us a bit about that.
So sometimes you get carte blanche, you create the team. If I think about the trip I did around America, I built the team. They were friends I knew, I trust them implicitly. You know, there was no, hello, how do you do? I'm Jake, you know, what's your name? Whereas for this last expedition, I didn't know anybody before I landed in Kathmandu. and met my team there, 11 of us from all over the world, lots of different countries represented. And we all, especially in the industry that we're in, we all like to think that creating great teams is around cherry picking the very best people. But it's often pretty rare that we're running, you know, the football team where you can choose the players on the pitch. And even if you're the manager, you often don't get complete carte blanche over your team members. And so how we, both as leaders, but more actually as followers and members of that team, how we build those relationships incredibly quickly becomes key, because ultimately in a matter of weeks, potentially even days, you are entering into an incredibly dangerous and risky environment where people's behaviors, activities, and actions could have significant effects on your experience or possibly even your life. Mm.
These analogies, that it's interesting, isn't it? In an organization, people often get promoted into a senior role or recruited into a senior role, and the expectation is that they'll perform almost immediately. And that acclimatization phase, which is very explicit and overt in your situation, but in most organizations is just kind of ignored a lot of the time. The assumption is that you just pull levers and performance comes out. But I think that it's interesting to consider that why that's the case. You know, maybe that in your situation, because it's so apparent that that is a physiological necessity, in organizations we don't seem to get that it's a psychological necessity. You know, that to build those relationships is so crucial. And even when you do have a team in a workplace that you know, often that's because you've been promoted from that team to now lead it. That's a poison chalice, if ever there was one, for anybody, isn't it? You know, so there's lots of interesting analogies here about this, I think, that do play out in the workplace, and some lessons maybe that organizations need to take from this kind of very explicit and clear example, that they could take back into their workplace and think, actually, we don't do that. We don't allow that time. We don't get acclimatized. People do get shipped into an area with no oxygen and expected to just go out and breathe. The helicopter arrives because sometimes it's the tallest pygmy. You know, you've been promoted into this role because there wasn't anybody else, and you're not even actually that well suited, and maybe don't climb very well. You know, you're now in it.
And I think to your point there, Nigel, that yeah, as we all know, and goodness, that's part of the reason why our industry exists, is that more often than not, development comes after the fact. Whereas if I think about my experience in the army, for instance, the military is pretty good at training people in advance. I guess part of that is because they have the opportunity to spend a greater proportion of your time and effort and investment in training people, rather than actually just doing the day job. And I think that bringing it back to the commercial world, where I've seen that mindset shift and that jumping into a new role work really effectively, is where, especially at very senior positions, new senior leaders have been very overt in saying, this is my 100 days, you know, almost like a new American president. Yeah. This is what I'm looking to achieve in these 100 days. And, you know, don't expect it to be tomorrow. I've only turned up this morning. Don't expect it, but this is where I want to get to.
It's unrealistic expectations and a lack of understanding of human nature, I think, is at play there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you'd met your new team at Kathmandu. You hiked into base camp, and in you're beginning your acclimatization. And wonder if you can tell us about, you know, leading up to the summit attempt, what the conditions were like, and also tell us a little bit about the role of the Sherpas in this, because I know they play a very important part.
Absolutely, and for too long, Sherpas have been sidelined as sort of the also rans and ignored. But actually, let's think back to what happened pretty much bang on 70 years ago, that a Kiwi beekeeper, a New Zealander, Edmund Hillary, and a Sherpa from Nepal, Sherpa Tenzing Norgay, reached a summit. And famously, they were both asked, or certainly Ed Hillary was asked numerous times, who got there first? And he refused to answer it, or would always just say, we both stepped onto the summit at the same time. And that Tenzing, and well, those of you who are purely listening won't be able to see, but it's actually a picture of Tenzing I have sitting behind me on the summit of Everest on my desk, rather than a picture of me or anybody else, because I find him, you know, truly inspirational. He wasn't a supporting member of the Everest expedition in 53. He was a genuine, fully fledged team member. Mm. And so Colonel John Hunt, who ran the expedition, recognized that Tenzing was an equal member of the team. So interesting that equality, even back in the 1950s on an expedition like that, became really key. Mm. And again, I think that, you know, there is a lot of relevance to us in our day-to-day of, you know, who's in the team, who's on the team, who's a supporter, who's a supplier, who's the client. And it's very easy to sort of slip into stratifying people's value they add, and therefore, you know, what they bring to the party, rather than actually thinking of them as human beings, and that they all have an equal role to play within it.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's interesting that how often I've gone on about this for years, that in organizations we often relate to each other as job titles and positions on a hierarchy, and we allocate value to that job title, not to the person who's in it. Mm. Which is bizarre when you think about it, because in your situation, when you're going up a massive mountain, the level of trust and commitment you have to each other goes way beyond any of that, because you know that that's success or failure. But it always is, just that in the commercial world, that's not how we see it. And so, you know, you can't get to achieve anything in an organization without the contribution of all the people that are required. But we value it in some kind of weird ladder. So you are worth this much a year, whereas you're only worth that much a year, even though you made the biggest contribution. It's an interesting analogy.
Absolutely. And recognizing how everybody has a part to play, and, you know, no person is an island, and it's very rare we achieve much in our lives entirely by ourselves. And if I even think, you know, going back to base camp, think about the sort of the risk of perception of hierarchy of the climbing members. So us international, I was going to say Western, but actually we were from all over the world, but, you know, non-Nepali fee-paying clients. You've then got your Sherdar, which is your Sherpa leader. You've then got your Sherpas, some of which are climbing Sherpas. And what that means is they are paired up with us. Others are essentially high altitude porters. So they're not sort of directly said, right, you know, Nigel, you know, Persang is yours, or Matt, Nima is yours, but they're just part of the support team. So they're a step down. And then you've got your kitchen staff, who are often just referred to as the kitchen staff. Mm. Well, if we don't eat well in base camp, and more to the point, if the food isn't clean and we get a bug, that's it, it's over. So in many ways, when you're in base camp, the most important people are the kitchen staff and the effectiveness of what they do. You know, it's a bit like the, you know, the people who work in technology in an organization. You know, if the technology isn't working, none of us can do our jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So can you take us through a little bit of the mechanics of climbing a mountain of this scale? Because again, in my ignorance, I assumed that you just sort of carried on climbing until you got to the top, but it's not like that, is it?
Yeah, so you have to acclimatize, which we spoke about earlier. The way that works is you do rotation. So you push up the mountain, you might just touch a camp, so you climb up to camp one and then you come straight back down, or you might sleep in a camp and then you come back down. And each time you do that, you build up your familiarity with the route, but you also build up your acclimatization. Essentially, your body is creating more red blood cells and making more efficient use of the transportation of what little oxygen that there is around the body. And that, again, is a vital stage. You know, like learning a new skill, you can't just expect to have that magic shot in the arm and suddenly be an expert at something. You have to keep just dipping your toe in and exposing yourself to this new skill or this new world. And it feels uncomfortable to start with. And when you're going up to altitude, you get headaches and you don't sleep very well. And it's pretty miserable quite a lot of the time. And yet that is part of the learning process. You know, that is you recognizing you are in your stretch zone, you are uncomfortable because you are developing yourself. And actually, as you become more comfortable, as you have your first night in base camp where you actually sleep throughout the night and aren't having to, you know, aren't lying awake because your head is pounding, or aren't having to get up for a pee every 5 minutes because essentially the diuretic effect of the environment, then you know that you are now becoming, well, a master of that altitude and or that skill.
And is that why they split it into several different camps as you go up? Or is that done basis on the basis that you just wouldn't physically be able to, even if you were acclimatized, go straight up to the top without stopping somewhere?
It's a bit of both. So sometimes the camps are in specific places because there are only very specific areas which are safe enough to have a camp in. And you wouldn't want to stick your tent, you know, in between those, because actually it's just too risky from avalanche or rockfall. There's absolutely the sense of, on the rotations, they provide the sort of the markers in the sand as to where you're going. You know, we've touched camp one, we come back down, we touch camp two. And then, yeah, I mean, whilst there are some amazing people who've done speed ascents where they've gone straight from base camp to the summit, but they've had to move incredibly quickly, for mere mortals like me, we use them to break the journey up. And again, whether or not that's skipping camps, so as I say, base camp to camp two, or it's, you know, just echeloning through camps on the way, as well as providing that safety and security both on the way up but also on the way down, because if the weather changes, you need to be close to somewhere where you can seek shelter.
And that's the point, isn't it, that with these mountains, there's generally or usually a very short period of time, a window in the season where you get the, you know, that there's going to be an opportunity to climb when the weather makes it okay to do that. And once that window opens, you then get teams, fixing teams. And again, this is something I didn't realize, there is a team whose job it is to put in a safety rope that leads the way.
Yeah, absolutely. So for all of these big mountains, there will be the fixing team. The fixing team will go up ahead and put in place this secure rope. And that will enable the climbers, and especially those who are going up and down numerous times, to then have that safe access route. You know, there wasn't a huge amount that I climbed that I wouldn't have felt comfortable climbing without a rope, but it's nice to know that there is one there.
Again, I'm thinking of all the analogies of this, that in an organization, you're often put in a position where you have to reach a base camp you're not ready for, because that's what the opportunity is, or that's what's required, and you don't acclimatize, and you're not actually physiologically aware of the fact that you're completely out of your depth or height, and that actually you're not performing. You don't find out till later. Whereas in your situation, I mean, imagine the sense of it going too far is quite quick. You can feel it when you, I suppose, if you know what it feels like.
Yeah, and so much of that comes from experience, and you see people going to altitude for the first time and either sort of ignoring the warning signs or overreacting to the warning signs, you know, and having a little bit of a gentle headache and thinking, oh my goodness, I've got cerebral edema, my head's going to explode, I need a helicopter out of here. And you're slightly thinking, this is just part and parcel, you know, this is what you signed up for. But until you know your own body, you listen to your own body, that can be very concerning for people, understandably. But as I say, the flip side of that is people who try and maintain that sort of stiff upper lip and that stoicism of, I've got a cracking headache, but I'm going to forge on regardless. Well, you need to listen to your body, but you also need to share that with other members of the team, because actually often your collective decision making may be based on the readiness of individuals.
Exactly analogous to the situation you're in most leadership teams and most teams of any description. It's interesting, isn't it? That experience that you have, which you didn't have the first time you went up Everest, how much did you learn from that first ascent, do you think?
So much. And I think the thing is that every time I go into the mountains, I learn a huge amount. I mean, there were things that I saw on the mountain this time, I was like, I can't believe I never knew that. You know, sometimes it's little sort of life hacks, you know, about where people put their sunglasses when they're not wearing them on their head so they don't drop them down the mountain. Or I remember on one expedition, somebody, in fact, it was a polar friend of mine who introduced me to the idea of using a flint and steel, you know, a piece of technology that's been around for tens of thousands of years to light your stove. Because at altitude, often, you know, the little Zippo or Clippy, you know, Clipper lighters don't work or break. Matches get soggy. And if you can't light your stove, you are in serious trouble. So having, you know, the old fashioned way that worked for our great, great ancestors in a cave somewhere, the flint and steel to make a spark, that is waterproof and altitude proof. So every time you go, always learning new things. So yeah, old dog, new tricks, love it.
Absolutely. And again, isn't that like being a leader in any walk of life? You know, I probably spend more time on my own professional development now than I did when I was 30. Because, you know, as you get more experience, you realize all the things you don't know rather than being pleased about the five things you've learned. You know, and it's it's amazing how alert you have to be and how much your radar has to be on to pick this stuff up. And sometimes arrogance prevents that, I think, in an organization. People feel like they have to put on this facade of being perfect because they're now in a senior role or whatever. And actually, all you are is a more advanced apprentice.
Yes.
Because you've got more things to know now than ever because it's more significant.
Yeah, you've got to do everything you did yesterday plus new things.
Yeah,
and you don't know how to do those new things. And so that humility is so important. Humility when learning, humility when in these environments. For me, obviously, it's the humility of my relationship with a mountain, but also that of my relationship with other climbers of varying experience. Some have got plenty more experience than me, others who have less experience. The relationship that I have with the inadverted commas support staff, the Sherpas, etc. Some of them might be significantly younger than me. Oh, but guess what? They've climbed Everest 10 times. You know, so actually, you know, old enough is or sorry, wrong, good enough is old enough here. It's not about time served. It's about actually the skills you bring and the ability in which you're able to share those skills and experience with other people.
Yeah.
So you've done your acclimatization process. I know that took a couple of weeks. And there's a lot of dealing with boredom at that point because you have to spend a certain amount of time in base camp and what have you. And then you're getting to the point, and I also know that there was some bad weather, so that delayed you a bit as well. But you're getting to the point where you're ready to make a summit attempt. Talk to us a bit about what you learned about the team dynamics and some of the challenges that you'd had leading up to that.
Yeah. So a lot of climbing, when you see the photos, you see the exciting stuff. What you don't see is the 98% of the time, which is boring, dull, tiring, miserable, etc. That recognition for us, especially in base camp, that was all part of the experience. That rest and recovery piece, when you're waiting for good weather, is key and is just as much part of the journey up the mountain as is physically gaining altitude. And it's always fascinating to see how different people react to it. And again, the microcosm of human behavior that you see on an expedition is like reality, but just condensed into sort of, you know, a very highly intensified world of reality. And you see people who are very fractious, who get very frustrated. You see people who are thinking, oh, if I'm sitting around, then I'm losing strength, therefore I've got to train, I've got to go and do silly things, I've got to go walking every single day. Now, I've seen people do that, and that's sometimes a good thing. I've seen it do to the point where they've injured themselves. You know, when you're resting, rest. You see people who just start to go off food. You know, the boredom and the banality of the situation starts to affect them in a physiological way, appetite, etc. You start to see mental health and how that plays into it. So it is that reality of almost everyday life. It's not always the sort of the Hollywood movie that we expect it is. It's all of the sort of the boring bits in between. And therefore, one of the key skills I've always prided myself on in the mountains is patience. and just, you know, rolling with the punches. And you think you're going up tomorrow, brilliant, you get excited, you pack all your kit, and then guess what? The weather changes and you spend another 5 days in base camp.
Isn't it interesting? I remember back in the 70s, I once spent a week in a very expensive recording studio watching engineers putting different sorts of T-shirt into a drum, for a bass drum, to try and get the sound right. Keith Richards said that, didn't he? He said that they don't pay me to play the guitar. I do that for free. They pay me for all the waiting around.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because you see that stuff going on when you're on the mountain. Mm. How often do leaders in organizations see that stuff going on around them? Because it's still happening. Mm. All those things are still happening. People having mental health issues. People are losing enthusiasm and engagement and losing their sense of direction and will to live sometimes. But often leaders in organizations are not aware. They're not alert to it, mm. especially not now, when they might not even be physically
in the same place.
Yeah. And it's so important because you know that it's life or death when you're in that situation. Mm. But it's, you know, it's commercial life or death for organizations every day. Sometimes, and sometimes literally for some people who end up like the head teacher in a school recently who suddenly committed suicide after a bad Ofsted inspection. You know, it can be very, very serious, and we need to take this stuff more seriously in order to use these kinds of lessons to bring them back into the workplace.
Mm. And that patient thing also brings us back to, again, humility about recognizing it's not all about you.
Yeah.
Whether or not you're a leader or a follower or a member of a team, that you are part of a community. And if you are all there to try and do something together, then a responsibility of being part of this community is that you shoulder the burden of your community. And, you know, you spend time with your teammates, that is not a responsibility. That's not the responsibility of the leader to ensure that everybody's mental health is good. It is an important part of their role, but it's part of everybody's responsibility to keep an eye out, to give your friend, your colleague, your coworker a listening ear, a friendly ear, a shoulder to cry on, kick up the backside when they need it, to provide them with that support to make them feel like this is a genuine team rather than people who are sitting on an organizational flowchart.
Eventually you did get the weather clearance and you did push up the mountain. Tell us about the summit attempt on Kanchenjunga.
So whenever you set off from base camp on a summit push, it's always incredibly exciting. It's a little bit apprehensive because you recognize this is it, that, you know, Ilia Iacta Est, the die is cast, off we go. And every step you take up the mountain gets you one step closer to the summit. But you also have to accept that part of the rules of the game that you've entered into is that at any stage, something might happen, which means that you have to turn around. Mm. And if somebody once said to me, they said, if you want to win, you have to be prepared to lose. If everything in life was guaranteed, well, nothing would be a challenge. Or if we only ever went for things that were guaranteed, we would never push ourselves. So when we got up to the top camp, we were poised, ready to go up to the summit. We were going to be leaving at 7 o'clock at night or 8 o'clock at night, so then climb all the way through the night. The fixing team hadn't completed the fixing. Normally what would happen is you would only go for the summit when the rope team had confirmed they had the rope in all the way to the top. But we were a little bit like sort of Wallace and Gromit laying the tracks in front of the train as we went, where the fixing team was just in front. So they had a few hours head start, and then off we went, and we relatively soon caught up with them. Now, without going into sort of tabloidy excitement over exactly what went wrong and certainly who did something wrong, let's just say that the fixing team got a little navigationally challenged on their way to the summit and essentially went right when they should have gone left and got into the wrong gully and ended up getting bottlenecked in the wrong direction. And whilst as the crow flies, they were heading directly for the summit, there were rock bands that ended up getting in the way. And by the time that was recognized, they'd essentially ran out of rope. We'd wasted 3 hours. And in their attempts to get through the rock band, which was proving elusive. They were dislodging so much rock that this was falling down and injuring us below them, you know, injuring climbers below them. So the Sirdar, our Sherpa leader, made a very simple decision very quickly. He was very disappointed, but he said, "That's it, you know, Endex, we have to go back down. We're not going to be able to get through up there. We don't have enough time, and we certainly don't have enough rope to go back down and then back round in the safe direction." And so we headed back down.
That's the end of part one. In part two, Jake talks about the reaction of the team to the failure, how he personally dealt with the setback, and how he came to go from that failure to the literal dizzying heights of the top of Mount Everest a mere 4 days later. Please do join us for part two. We hope you've enjoyed this. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the topics discussed today. You can find us on LinkedIn by searching Inspirational Development Group, or email us on info@inspirationaldg.com. If you would like to learn more about IDG and the work we do optimizing human performance through leadership development, you can find us at inspirationaldevelopment.com.